the dreams for me, I had to let go.
Right.
I believe in my own. I think oftentimes we try to live our parents' dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work. You know, in the long run, it doesn't work. I wanted to be in show business as a very young child. And my grandfather, who was a powerhouse in the industry, he said, "You stay out of it. It's a filthy business." So I didn't tell anybody till I was 26 years old.
Wow.
I know, and that's late.
Yeah.
That's late, Paul.
That is Emmy and Golden Globe winner Sharon Glass from Cagney and Lacey, Queer as Folk, and Burn Notice, a really, really terrific actress. I absolutely love this conversation because she pulls no punches, as they say, talking about her life. She's got a new memoir out, and there she's talking about just the sacrifice she made of, waiting until she was 26 to finally come out and say she wanted to be an actress, which was something she wanted to do since she was a little kid. So I really think this is something you're going to enjoy because she just gives you a window into a life that no one had any idea about until she started talking about it. Before we get to that full interview, I'm on Amtrak. Need a few rules on Amtrak. Now, you're allowed, unless you're in a quiet car, you're allowed to talk on your phone, which is fine. But understand that there are other people around you, okay? So I'm on the train, and I got a guy who's having a Zoom meeting on the train. Okay, do you really need to have the Zoom meeting on the train? Are you that important? Really? You can't wait, okay? Secondly, you don't need to yell at the screen. You're not a 105-year-old person who doesn't understand how technology works. They can still hear you. The microphone isn't in the screen. There's a microphone somewhere else, and you talk the way I'm talking right now. I wanted him arrested. I don't know if it was for the stupidity of not knowing that you don't have to yell at the screen like a 1,000-year-old person, or that he just was obnoxious and didn't care that there were, I don't know, 60 other people in the car with him. The last time I looked, my Amtrak train ticket did not include, for free, listening to this moron's Zoom meeting call. And by the way, he didn't let anybody else talk on the call. Horrible employee, worst boss ever. Okay, I'm glad I got that off my chest. Enjoy Sharon Glass, everybody. And thanks for checking out the podcast. We'll see you next week. I have such a treat to have this guest on my show this week. Multiple Emmy and Golden Globe winner, known for her amazing work on breakthrough shows like Cagney and Lacey, Queer as Folk, Burn Notice, which I loved. She has a new memoir out. Apparently, there were complaints. Sharon Glass, it's so great to have you on.
Thank you, Paul. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Now, I got an interest of full and flared disclosure. I got to be honest with you. I had a thing for you. You're a lovely woman, and you were kind
all
of
right.
A little bit of a hottie to me. You know what I'm saying? And and in fact, if you see my wife, you will see that there is a resemblance between the two of you. So you might have had some influence in terms of who I ended up marrying. But I just had to get that out of the way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My older brother married a woman who did not look unlike me.
There you go. You're like this muse. Well, it's so great to have you on, and I'm glad you wrote this book. First of all, it's not a tell-all book, which I really like. And I absolutely laughed out loud when I saw the title. And I actually thought until I started reading it, I thought the title was, okay, well, this is going to be that she was difficult to work with and there were complaints from people on the set or whatever. But it's really the complaints reference is more to your family. I guess you were a bit of a rebel, particularly, I think you said, as a teenager. So what was that about, and why were you rebelling, and what kind of things were you doing, and all of that?
I imagine I'm certainly not the first teenager to rebel.
Right.
As a teenager, really, I did as I was told, but there was pain inside. you know. I was raised in a very strict way in Los Angeles. I was raised in my grandmother's house. She was very formal. Manners were of the utmost importance. And she had dreams for me that I just didn't have for myself. And so it was oftentimes, I spent a great deal of my young life disappointing her, which is painful for a teenager, you know, because I'm a people pleaser. I mean, doesn't everybody want everybody to like them if they're worthy?
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just, things started out with my size as a youngster, how I conducted myself, how I modulated my voice, the way I was being raised, and the dreams that were planned for me of marrying a nice, brilliant lawyer and having beautiful children and doing charity work. And, you know, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I knew that having children, I knew, was probably one of the most responsible, awesome tasks any person could take on. And I honored that. And I said, it ain't me.
Good for
I'm
you.
Sure everyone, this would say, yeah, it would say, I know this is going to put you in therapy for 20 years, but no, the answer is no, you may not. Right? That's the kind of mother I'd be. I was raised by a mother who was very loving and very strict, and would say, as I'm sure you hear parents say, someday you'll thank me.
Mm.
And I thank her till the day I die.
You did. Because she let you, because she let you have pursue your dreams. Because you said the book is about dreams and letting them go. Does that mean your dreams or the dreams that other people had for you, and having the courage to let them go and pursue what was new that you knew was true to you?
Well, the dreams were about my dreams for my the dreams for me. I had to let go,
right?
I believe in my own. I think oftentimes we try to live our parents' dreams,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't work. You know, in the long run, it doesn't work. I wanted to be in show business as a very young child, and my grandfather, who was a powerhouse in the industry, he said, "You stay out of it. It's a filthy business." So I didn't tell anybody until I was 26 years old.
Wow.
I know, and that's late.
Yeah.
That's late, Paul.
Well, I know the feeling, because I grew up middle class in Rhode Island. My parents were high school educated. And I ended up going to Georgetown Law School, and I worked on Wall Street as a lawyer and an investment banker. And then I left to go into comedy and entertainment, and completely turned my life upside down. And
which one was your parents' dream? Which one was yours?
It's funny. I think clearly, you know, my son's a lawyer, a doctor, right? My parents were like beside themselves, right? And I was working at one of the biggest law firms in the world, doing corporate deals, M&A deals. And I thought, it's a great question. Wow. I don't want to make this too much about me, but I thought that was my dream too, until this stuff started coming out of me in law school. I started writing sketch ideas and short film ideas and comedy and jokes, and it just overtook me. And in therapy, in other ways, I figured out that it kind of picked me. I didn't pick it. And I fought it and said exactly what you were thinking. Am I going to do this? Because the world expects me to do this, and I'm a lawyer, and it'd be proper and this and that. Am I going to go and entertain people? Like I was a mess for a long time until I sorted through it and ended up just having to go with my heart and my gut. So I know what that feeling is like very, very much.
Well, in your defense, I think some of our best trial lawyers, some of our best actors in our country are really trial lawyers. Right. You know, they lives depend on their how they perform.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think you had the best of both worlds. I mean, you're so good at what you do now, but I think you had wonderful classic training. Some people went to RADA. You went to law school.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I had to negotiate with some real characters when I was on Wall Street. And then, you know, my parents didn't understand, but then I ended up getting on the Daily Show as a performer and a writer on that show. And when we got our first right. Emmy Award, and I came home with the Emmy Award and took a picture of it with my mother, this big shiny thing, which I know you have also, I think she kind of was like, oh, okay. Cause she would live vicariously through other people who became to know the show and said, oh, your son works on that show. That's a great show, blah, blah, blah. And then she started to appreciate it, but it was very hard. But I don't want to make this about me, but I totally get that.
That's about you. I get it.
When your grandfather said it's a filthy business, I know you mentioned he was a powerhouse lawyer in entertainment with some really big clients. Did you find it to be in your own experience of quote unquote filthy business? You obviously sound like you've loved your career. How did you find it once you really was in it, got into it, head, hands and feet?
Well, my experience when I first went into it as a young contract player at Universal, I had a magnificent woman who was head, first female vice president of MCA. And she was tough. And everybody was afraid of her, but she was head of talent and procuring new talent to be put under contract to the largest television studio in the world. And she made the difference. Her name is Monique James. She was formidable. She was scary, because we all knew who she was and wanted her to know it. But she trained me. She trained me on the job. She took me into screening rooms and forced me to watch films, some of it bad, and forced me to look up at that and say, don't do that again. I was given opportunities to work with the wonderful actors of my era, of that early television era. They were my acting lessons themselves. James Garner, Robert Wagner, Eddie Albert. I got trained by the best. And I learned also a kindness from those men. There were no women starring in series in those days. In those dramas, but they were decent guys and showed me not only how to conduct myself on camera, but also how to conduct myself on the set.
I mean,
and the respect they paid.
What's amazing that I didn't realize so reading the book, you were one of the last quote unquote contract players in Hollywood. And for people who don't know who aren't in the business, there was a system where you were like signed to a professional sports team. You were signed to a studio and you worked on those, unless that studio loaned you out to another studio, you worked on projects under the heading of that studio, but you got this training that, you know, look, I go to acting classes. I have an acting coach and all of that. People don't get that anymore. They have to figure it out on their own. And your life would have been very different, I would imagine, had you not gone through that system.
Oh, I'm so grateful to have gone. People used to say, don't sign that contract. You'll never be heard from again. Right. I said, nobody's heard of me now. So what? I went. They paid me $186 a week. I couldn't have been happier. I got to be on all the television shows and I got to study how bad I was and then learn how good I could get.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. It was the Edith Head wardrobe department.
Oh my God.
I know, in the Westmore makeup building. The old pros towards the end of that era of the contract system, studio era, were all there. Mm-hmm. And I got to be one of them. I didn't care that, yes, I wanted to be in features, and Universal Studios never let their contract players be in features. You only did television.
Oh.
Now, I wanted to play Carol Lombard in Universal Studios. Had a movie called Gable and Lombard with James Brolin. And I can't rest your soul. God, I can't remember your name. God rest your soul. Joe Clayburgh, I believe. Mm-hmm. They signed. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I could do Carol Lombard. And anyway, they wouldn't even consider me because I was just a contract player. But Warner Brothers borrowed me from Universal and had me play Carol Lombard in Moviola.
Oh.
The miniseries, The Scarlet O'Hara Awards.
Right, right. Did you find, you said, the quote of yours is, in the parallel universe of my life, I had no idea where to go or what to do about my feelings. Was that tied to, because you're very open in the book about, you know, your bout with alcoholism, was that kind of harken back to what we were talking about earlier, sort of you harbored these goals and desires and passions that you kind of had to bury in your family? And was alcohol a way to deal with it? And what did you mean by that? Well, in the parallel universe of my life, I had no idea where to go with my feelings.
Well, my goal had always been to be happy. And I came from a long line of drinkers. The cocktail hour was revered at my house. It was that era, you know. The
right.
bar was open 5, if not earlier.
Right.
And it's just something you always saw. People had cocktails in their hands or libations in their hands. And when I was old to drink, then I tried it. And boy, that felt good. And then as time went on, I started to enjoy it more and more. And but never after, not before 5 o'clock. I will defend myself. I wasn't a drinker on the set or on the show. But it made me feel good. Gave me confidence. Never on the set. I knew it threw my timing off. But like if I had to go to a studio party, I'd have a drink while I'm putting on my makeup. I thought, oh, well, that felt good. Okay. I'll have maybe one more just to make my hair look better.
Right. Suddenly I'm taller and my breasts are bigger. Look at this. This is amazing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. The problem as a result of it didn't show up for many years later.
Yeah. And what was it that I know you've talked about sort of, you know, having some of these moments like all alcoholics do where you're like, oh, wow, you were screaming at somebody about their kids at a party. Was it sort of a combination of things where you just was like, okay, this is the breaking point. I got to walk away from this or it's going to kill me. Did you have an intervention from someone?
I had an intervention. Ronnie Meyer, my agent. A very famous man in the industry, but at the time he formed CAA and I was one of his very few television clients. He only had a much bigger people. But he took me to dinner one day and we were really close. And I said, I know you're taking me to dinner because I'm putting on weight. And he said, no, actually that is why I'm taking you to dinner. I'm taking you to dinner because I think you're an alcoholic.
Wow.
I was so offended. So offended.
Yeah.
I said, Ronnie, I've known you for 17 years. I've had drinks with you throughout our entire career together. He said, I know, but it's different with you now. And I looked down at my table and there were four empty martini glasses.
Wow.
And I think Ronnie did that on purpose. I think he told the waiter, don't take away the empty ones.
Oh.
I wanted to see it.
Wow.
And I had the clue, and that's the truth. And I said, Ronnie, you have to stop. Please stop. People are listening. And he said, let them listen. I don't care if I lose you a client. I don't care if I lose you as a friend. But I'm afraid I'm going to lose him.
Good for him. That's a big problem in life, especially in this business, is people care about the money so much. They don't care about the person. And they that's a great human being right there.
Yeah, he is a very good guy. We're still friends to this day.
You said something really fascinating, which to me is the older you got, the less afraid you became. You said, the older I got, the less afraid I became and the more dangerous I wanted to play. Is that just because you get reach a point where you're like, yeah, screw it. You know, I am who I am. People can accept me the way I am one way or the other. Or is it because you're secure with awards and money and everything else and you can take chances that maybe you felt you couldn't take when you were a younger actress? What is that about?
I get more brave as I go along, but I was brave as a kid. Mm. The thought of failure, this sounds weird, but Paul, the thought of failure never occurred to me.
Really?
Once I admitted what I wanted to do, and I had my grandpa's approval, and flying into LA with my money for my acting class, and I was broke, you know, when I started. But I had somebody's approval that meant a lot to me. I knew the performing and the getting a job and all that was totally on me. Nobody was going to do that for me. But sometimes you get an epiphany in your life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving over LA and about the land in LA, which is my home. I was born there. And I just thought, I will not fail. My grandfather said, that's crazy. You think I'd try and stop you? And I didn't want any, I used the expression, I don't want any trouble. I didn't want any trouble. Mm-hmm. But there was nobody after that who could stop me. I got a job during the day as a secretary, but they let me have Thursdays off so I could earn money. Because my acting class was on Thursdays. Mm. And things started falling into place. A director called me saying, you're the best production secretary I've ever seen. Mm. Come and work with me. I said, you'll laugh if I tell you. He said, tell me. I said, I'm going to be an actor. He said, I'm not laughing. What are you going to do for money? I said, I'm going to get a night job. And he said, you got Thursdays off. Now what? Mm. And everything just fell into place. And within a year, Universal Studios had heard about me, asked me to come in and prepare a scene, and they signed me that night.
Wow. That's amazing. That's fast. Yeah. That's fast. Good for you.
Yeah.
I could talk to you forever, so I want to get you back on to talk more about your life in the book, but everyone needs to go out and get this book and read it. It's really terrific. Apparently, there were complaints, which is the best title of a book I've ever heard. Great to have you on, and it was really great to meet you, and congratulations on all your success.
Thank you so much.
That was Sharon Glass. Hope you enjoyed it. I thought she was terrific, and check out our new book. It's really, really good. Thank you for checking out the podcast. As usual, tell friends and family about it. Hope you guys have a great holiday, and also that you can see what I'm doing on YouTube. We got a lot of YouTube stuff posted, as well as on my Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and Meta, I guess it's Meta now. Ugh, God. Please, can that go away? TikTok. Yes, I'm on TikTok because, you know, that's what all the kids are doing. And it's all at Paul Mercurio. And hope you guys follow me there. And thanks again for this week checking out the podcast. And we will see you soon.